The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
It was the worst week for markets in 2017. The healthcare bill's a no-go, and advertisers pulling ads from Google. All this and much more on episode number 502 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello there. This is Andrew Horowitz, and it is episode number 502. It's the end of March 2017. You're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, where we come together each and every week to talk about all sorts of things financial, investing, money related, and maybe a little bit of investor psychology, behavioral finance here and there. But we have a lot of things to talk about this week. I'll mention that next week coming up, we have a guest that we haven't had on for some time. You may have heard of him. You may remember him. It's been a while. Tim Sykes. Tim Sykes is a noted trader. Some love him, some hate him, but you got to admire his way of trading very small caps, penny stocks, to be clear, on both the short and the long side, and he does quite the job of it. He's a world traveler. He oftentimes is blogging, commenting, and trading from all sorts of areas around the world. Make sure to be there when he's on, because there's always something exciting. He's a friend of mine going back way back, and I think that it's time to have him back. I'll also mention, before we go anywhere, that last week I talked about the Investology offering. You know, this is the advisor-crafted, technology-enhanced platform that we're building. And I had mentioned that if you would like to be a part of the beta test, which is a live, real money, absolutely exactly what you're going to get when you go on it, but we're looking for people to help us get some feedback on the process of going through the risk tolerance surveys, the application process, the money funding, and kind of the total look and feel of the offering and the platform itself, to make sure there's no bugaboos in there. Because a lot of you have asked before to be a part of that, I had offered that this will be the last week that we'll be taking beta testers. Again, only if you're interested in helping out with feedback on a real money basis. So you have to deposit some money in there, go through the process of the application, getting the account opened and all of that. Pretty cool platform. It's going to be based with mutual funds and ETFs, a lot different than your standard, we'll call it the old, what they call them, robo-advisors. This is kind of a hybrid between the technology that's used with robo-advising as well as us managing your money for you. So we'll be actively managing the money as well. What you can do is go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, this show episode or last show episode, but 502. Click on the show notes, take a look at that, and on the bottom there's a little form there, and click off the button that says, yes, I want to be a part of the beta test. Again, it's only going to be through the end of this week, so we'll say right through the end of March that we're going to be accepting. We had a good amount of beta tests, but if you want to get in on that, you know, and help us out, you know, please do so. All right. We have some listener questions to go over. I'm going to probably do that earlier than later. But let's talk about some technical levels. What happened last week with the S&P 500? Well, we know that it was a week that was focused on this, the healthcare bill and the various times that we saw that there was going to be a yes vote, or it looked like there was going to be the passage of this, that markets seemed to rally because the hope was that once this happened, there was going to be a tremendous amount of savings. That savings would be put into tax reform and tax benefits for corporations and individuals, which of course we also know is what has been driving markets. The whole idea of some kind of tax plan, a benefit to to corporations, bringing down their tax rates will immediately hit the bottom line, thereby making them more profitable. And of course, more profitability means that they have better earnings per share. Earnings per share, and look at multiples. Well, that can give us what is going to be the pricing for stocks moving forward. And that has been a big driver in this whole rally. I would say that if we look at the various components, the potential for a repeal of Obamacare, which would, in a way, help companies and soften some of the cost factors, it would probably be detrimental to individuals. But again, I'm talking about from a stock market standpoint. And you look at deregulation and you look at the repatriation. All these things combined helped move the rally. Of all of these things, I would have to say that if I was just to give a rough number, I would say about 70% of the rally has been due to the fact that there's going to be the expectation of tax reform, tax savings, tax benefits, higher earnings potential just because of that with companies. And that 70% is now in question. Because when you look at what happened, there was about, I don't know, somewhere between $300 to $500 billion of savings that were going to be put into play over the next number of years that would be able to be offset by any tax cuts, thereby having a quote-unquote revenue-neutral tax cut plan. And now we're talking about, well, the potential of increasing the deficit and possibly the need to raise the debt ceiling. Now, how is that going to go over? I don't want to get into the whole process and discussion of what happened with regard to why the bill was pulled and why they didn't have... Obviously, the bill wasn't... It wasn't enough quality and differential and benefit to have the majority of the House of Representatives go and say, yeah, well, we're willing to get to the next level of this, pass it on to the Senate, and then move on for their changes, et cetera. It obviously wasn't. Now, some people, if you want to start getting into the whole political discussion of it, go to another show, first of all. Go to another forum. But really, I just don't think we could really go that direction. There just wasn't enough for all of the various components of the makeup of the right, the hard right, the left, the hard left, you know, everybody involved was not buying into this. So in the end, it doesn't matter. Let's just throw that all out. The fact is it didn't pass. So now we're talking about moving on to taxes and the desire for the president and Republicans and everybody to get on board with this whole tax reform and cutting taxes and moving forward with that as quickly as possible. Again, I think they're going to end up running into a few. It's not as going to be as easy as they say it's going to be. Clearly, it's a lot more palatable. Who doesn't want to save taxes? But then again, you got to look at government funding here. Now, one of the things that we did see was that, let me take you through Friday, because I think it was really interesting what happened here. And a lot of people are scratching their head saying, why did this happen the way it happened with regard to the markets? Let's talk about some things that went on. So first of all, we did see that going into the vote, as we had expected it to be at about 3:30 in the afternoon, somewhere around there, markets started to sell off because a lot of the comments out of many of the key Republican and various politicians had said, well, we don't think we have enough votes to make this happen. And markets started to sell off into that. Once they decided to pull the bill from the vote, all of a sudden markets turned around on a dime, and move higher. Now, a few things were probably reason for that. One is that we actually got the S&P 500 just above the 50-day moving average. It actually landed on the 10-week moving average. This is the second time in the last couple of days. It landed on the 10-week moving average and bounced off. This is a key support levels. The 50-day moving average is more important. The 50-day moving average is clearly an important. Now, you say that we've talked about this. Why? This number, why this 50-day moving average do we oftentimes see for stocks, for indices? Why is this something that is so important? And I'll tell you why. because we've made it important. Somewhere along the line, institutions in particular have said that the 50, the 100, and the 200, sometimes they talk about the 150. I mean, you can start just saying, well, why not every moving average? But the 50 clearly is an important level. That is an area that buyers will step in and say, we are willing to buy once it hits the 50, because we've seen in the past, and if you look back historically, that the 50-day moving average is usually an area that things have support at. And once you have support at those levels and a buy-in by most players, you get consensus. And the consensus would say, well, the 50-day moving average is something that I'm going to buy. And everybody starts believing that. So whether or not you want to look at this as hocus pocus or you want to say that, well, it's extremely important and give me some kind of reason, the fact is it's just a buy-in and consensus by the masses. There's nothing wrong with that. If we know that and we know that to be true, then use it to your advantage. So we're getting very close to the key support levels on the S&P 500. Now, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is still above the 20,449 level, which is the 50-day moving average. It's about 150 points away from the actual level. It had 7 down days, lost about 400 points in the last 7 days, about down about 575 points from the all-time high on, I believe that was the 1st of March, 2017. So that market itself is not really bouncing in any technical range. In fact, I would go so far as saying that the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the Dow, well, it has some more downside potential to meet its 50-day moving average of about 150 points down. And we'll see what happens, because remember that support becomes resistance, resistance becomes support. So what will happen is if we actually break down below the 50-day moving average, the next level you have is potentially the 100 and then the 200-day moving average. I encourage you to have those on any charts that you are working with. By the way, this is a side note that I haven't done a tremendous amount of research on, but something I think is really interesting that, you know, did you see this whole announcement by TradeStation that they're going to a flat $5 fee for stock trading, no platform fees, and no NYSE and NASDAQ real-time trading information feeds? So the pricing fees that you usually have to pay for, the platform fees you usually have to pay for, are all free now? You got to look. Somebody look into that for me. I've talked to my friends over at TradeStation. You know, they're really close in proximity to me here. They're 15 minutes down the road. I have lunch with the VPs quite often. I haven't gotten into the details of what you have to do to get this. I think it's pretty easy, though. So you have no longer any roadblocks to get into this. Now you're saving a ton of money for the best platform that's out there in terms of their overall charting abilities. And not to mention, if you do that, this is now going to switch over to a little bit of a plug here, but you can get the trigger charts, which we have designed the algorithms and a variety of very important indicators that are on TradeStation. You can get those now without the problem of having to pay for the platform. I mean, you still have to pay for our algos and all that, but I mean, you're saving so much money by not paying for platform fees and not paying for the real-time streaming price quote fees. I mean, that's pretty impressive. Anyway, somebody check that out for me, will you? And get back to me. And if you want, by the way, you can always communicate with me very easily on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Go over to the Ask Andrew section right on the top there and just send me the information right there. But getting back to this here, there is a very important test of technicals that will be happening very soon. We're going to have to watch for that. But also we have to look at oil. Now, why do I say that? Why do we have to look at oil? Because if you do notice that there has been some correlation with regard to the markets, equity markets, and the price of crude. Crude is now at about $48 a barrel, down pretty well from its recent high, even though the jawboning by OPEC and now Russia and non-OPEC has been flooding the airways We saw that last week there was about a 5 million barrel build. 5 million barrel build, try to say that. And we're seeing that inventories are at significant highs. There was a listener question about that last week. We have one actually this week as well, which we'll talk about some of that. And but the thing is that there is a important component here. People wonder, why does oil affect markets? Well, there's a couple of different reasons why. It could be that oil is actually being affected by the dollar to a degree because pricing and when you look at the price of oil and you look at the price of the dollar, the US dollar, some, you know, it doesn't always work together. In fact, there is a higher probability of a higher dollar is a lower oil, but now we have lower oil and lower dollar. So that's a problem. But when we look at the oil pricing, while it is good for certain areas, and you can make the case that lower price of oil is actually good for consumers, well, that hasn't been playing out so well either. Look at some of the retail stocks and the retail wrecks that are out there. Lower prices of oil also will turn into lower profitability for many of the oil companies, and the lower profitability of the oil companies will actually drag on S&P earnings, and that's why you do see some of that downstroke when you see oil moving down so dramatically. So oil plays a little role in there well, but I still think as well too. But I still think the biggest issue right now is that there is a tremendous amount of confidence and complacency. Look at the VIX. It was recently as low as it got to right at 11. It moved above 14 on Friday as markets were selling off. When the actual healthcare bill was pulled from the vote, it started to sink as markets went higher. But still, you look at the VIX and you have to say that there is, with all of the things that are standing ahead of us, when we look out and we see that North Korea is sending off rockets. I don't care if they're bottle rockets or if they're nuclear rockets. They have ambition for a much bigger arsenal of weapons to be used, or at least to be waved in front of countries that they believe are, you know, hurting them. The U.S. obviously being a key player here. And they have desire, ambition, and it seems that they have some of the technical abilities right now to actually create a variety of weapons that could, in fact, impact many countries that are not only in their region, but in, you know, outside their region. Now, are they going to have, you know, the ability to have the range to reach here? That's way far off. But they can have the range to reach some of our allies. We have that. You have in China, we did see the gigantic injections by the PBOC, the People's Bank of China, last week, where they had to inject billions of dollars into the banking system as many small banks were failing to meet their payments and funding requirements. They have basically zero money. There was a massive injection last week. We have still elections around the world. Now, the point of bringing this all up is not to say, oh, markets are going to drop and it's going to be crazy and we're going to see all sorts of problems and this one is going to be a reason for a market crash and that one's going to be a reason for a market crash. All I'm talking about is that we see a lot of potential headwinds, and there's always headwinds. Let's not get that mixed up in this either, that, oh, Andrew, he's complaining again about this. No, there's always headwinds. But some of the headwinds right now are actually serious. There's some real things that are going on around the world that should be having investors on a higher alert, higher level of anxiety, but it's not. So one of a few things is going on. Either we could say the VIX is totally manipulated and there's no way to really look at this any further as a viable instrument to gauge the concern, the fear, the anxiety of investors. Or we could say that, well, recently there's been a tremendous amount of complacency due to the fact that, well, there's going to be all sorts of great things happening by central banks. They're going to continue to keep interest rates very low and pour money and liquidity into markets. And on top of that, now we're seeing that this populism movement is creating an additional layer of excitement over the idea that governments are really going to now start doing something that will reverse some of the very difficult regulatory environments that they've had over the last 10 years or so. Not to mention that we have to say that there has been some better than expected numbers in the manufacturing and a variety of other core areas of the global economy. Now, whatever the reason that is, if it's either transitory and temporary or it's something that is going to play out longer term, or maybe it's just because we're seeing that there's a lot of optimism out there due to some of the plans that will be put in place in the U.S., which is a major source of the global economy, then we can say that as long as we get and match the expectations to reality, as long as that matches, then we're fine. If in fact we do start to see that some of the promises and expectations that we have that are built into stock prices are flawed, well, you know the answer to that question, don't you? Well, what's going to happen? Well, things will adjust. That's what will happen. And if we don't have, if we go from the expected, in the best case scenario, we're going to have a 15% corporate tax rate, and now all of a sudden that changes to, 25? That's a big differential, isn't it? How are they going to answer for that, and how are markets going to answer? Or are we just going to be able to work with that narrative and look at that as something that's going to be the next reason why, it's not as bad as we thought it would be, or, it's not as good as we thought it would be, but however, we'll talk about narratives in a moment. I got a few things to say about that. Let's get on to a couple of listener questions, but after that, let me tell you what I'm going to talk about. Don't turn this off, okay? I'm going to talk about this whole BS with the best funds, top stocks, top 10 funds, top 25 stocks. I'm going to talk about this whole concept of what's going on there. I'm also going to talk about the narrative. The narrative. You've heard this a lot lately, right? This whole, the narrative. Narrative fitting is something that I've really got under my skin lately. This whole idea of this word, this phrase, and what it's being used for and how it's manipulated. But let me not get too deep into that because I may get a little crazy. But let's talk about some of the listener questions that came in. And this first one, I can't get to all of them on every show, so sometimes things sit for a little while. This one was from actually the end of February. And I believe I answered this by email. But I wanted to talk about this again because I didn't answer it on the show. This is from Rob G. And he writes, "Hi, Andrew, you spoke about certain indicators that are based on volumes. I recently identified a divergence on the XLE ETF, which is the energy sector. I'd like to hear what you think about a buy signal on energy right now. Your show is great, and I recommend it to others often. Thanks." Hey, well, first of all, thanks for recommending the show to others. I think that is something that I really don't ask very often, and I don't remind people to do very often, but why not? So easy just to click a button and say, hey, listen to this, or tweet it out, or, re-comment it on Facebook or whatever. There seems to be, to answer your question, there seems to be a bit of the has-been, and I'm going to go back to the date that you asked this, and because some of the notes I wrote down on here back then, as well as some of the follow-up notes on this. If you go back then, there seemed to be a disagreement with the price of crude and how it was playing and the actual price of the XLE. XLE seemed to be holding up very well, and it seemed to be hanging in there even as oil was starting to come down. Usually you'll see that there is a high correlation between the price of the ETF, which is the XLE, the energy sector, and oil, which makes sense. I don't think anybody's going to argue that. But I didn't see this divergence necessarily. What I did see was that that there was a follow through from the stocks that was based on markets, that the whole market was being pulled up, even in the face of a lower oil at that time, or at least an oil that was starting to roll over. And I really didn't see this whole divergence thing. I mean, again, there was a small amount, but I didn't take it as, well, this is something to really look at, because maybe what we're seeing is that the oil companies are leading the indicator. However, the problem is, and the problem maintained being, that they still follow the price of crude oil. I think there was a lot of anticipation, because if you remember back a few weeks ago, I talked about how, I think it was on this show or DH Unplugged, one of the two shows, I talked about how there was the highest levels of speculators buying futures on the long side than there has been in history. People thought that oil was going to continue just moving higher after all the OPEC discussions and non-OPEC and the cuts in production. But when we saw the reality that even with all those cuts in production, that inventories kept rising at a record pace, oil started to roll over, realizing that either, well, rig count is up. We see that rig count is up each and every week on Fridays. Baker Hughes puts out their rig count numbers, and we saw that, I think there was an ad of about another 20 that have been put back online this week. And this is following about, I think, 8 or 9 from the week before. And when you have rig counts up because oil prices are up, what's happening is more companies are pumping, therefore offsetting any of the cuts that happened by OPEC. I mean, you know, so we knew this was going to happen. There was kind of a lift that was being generated due to the idea that there was the opportunity for lower inventories if in fact OPEC would stick to their output cuts, but the probability wasn't that wasn't going to happen. So we then look at the reality, and we're seeing that oil prices have continued to move lower. And I just don't think that I would look at that right now as something that is a solid play, unless you want to look at the longer term and say, well, maybe in 5 years from now, 3 years from now, 2 years from now, that you will have higher oil. And if you have higher oil, well, then it makes sense to start investing more into the XLE ETF, because long term you'll be much better off. It has a multiplier effect. But I'm sorry, I didn't see that particular divergence in that. And again, I think there was outside influences that was happening there. And once oil came down, that's when you started to see that the XLE also, you know, started to moderate. This next question is from Jerry V. He asked me, what's your opinion on the trading strategy of selling half a position that has doubled in price? Do you sell half to lock in your profits, or do you let it ride? Well, I think, Jerry, I think there's two things to think about. First of all, did you have a price target on the upside? Did you look at what would be a price that you said would be a fair value or an upside value from the stock, either from a technical standpoint or a fundamental standpoint? And if you did have those numbers, because doubling in price, which is, by the way, congratulations, that's awesome. That's great. What I would look to do is, if it has in fact hit your upside price, you don't know if there is actually any kind of further move, because there may be other people who are pricing this much higher. You just don't know right now because you're outside your range. And what I would do is possibly take half the position and put a sell stop down lower, find out where the support is, put it a little bit below support, and if it gets down at that price, then it sells half your position. Let the other position ride to get to the next price target, and then if you want to get out of that, if it's not a long-term hold, if it's a trading position, think about another sell stop on that. That's a good way to work with positions, you know, having sell stops. So thanks for that question, Jerry. Jay, who is this here? I want to say JS from Harvard. Question is, hey, Andrew, first, your podcast and the information I have gleaned over the past several years have been enlightening and more important for me. Though I think I am savvy with my money, savings, and investments, I want to ask you about DIAs. I read a depth article about them and wonder how they might pertain to investing. I might be interested in the future. I'm 6 years old and I have this much money, et cetera. Thanks. You know, I answered this by email as well, but I think what we're talking about here is DIAs. What are these? This is a dynamic allocation, if you will, dynamic investment allocations, where they look to find relative lows in markets and highs, and they have a portfolio of various sectors. And what they do is they are finding those areas that are overvalued and in markets in general that are overvalued. And what they're doing is saying, well, those we're going to have a smaller position or no position. And those that are undervalued, we're going to have a higher position. And we're going to rotate the portfolio on a regular basis. One of the problems is I've run a lot of simulations with this concept of doing things like, well, let's take all the S&P 500 sectors and maybe even global sectors. And we put it into a variety of different simulators to look at what would happen if we took the ones that had performed the best over the 1, 2, 3 months and actually cut them back, put them into the ones that have not performed and kind of continually do that. It works, but there's nothing, there wasn't a statistical significance in that process versus looking at the just buy and hold, you know, comparison of having an equally weighted portfolio potentially of, let's say, 5 or 6 different sectors, or maybe even 10 different sectors. We've tried to say, well, if you have the greatest loss in 1 month or the greatest gain in 1 month, hold it for a month, then sell part of it or all of it and rebalance it down and move it back into the others. I mean, the whole concept of rebalancing does make sense, but when you start thinking about overweighting in these automated processes just by the nature of just because it went up, just because something goes up or just because something goes down does not necessarily mean that you should either buy it or sell it. There has to be more reason. If it's gone down due to the fact that, well, there's something very inherently wrong. Remember what happened with Brazil for years? If you were to keep on putting money into the Brazilian market over the last number of years, and every time it was down, you'd end up losing, you know, 20, 30, 40% of your money. You'd have most of your money sitting in the Brazilian stock market as it was continuing lower. So the whole idea somehow fails a little bit when you're looking to buy things that are on the lows or at least moving lower. Why would you want to buy a loser? Don't you want to buy a winner? If in fact there was a time that you would have said, well, I didn't want to buy the S&P right now. I'd rather put it into, pick your poison, whatever it is, a market that isn't doing well. Well, the S&P kept on moving higher recently. Now, there may be a time that turns, of course, but the S&P moved higher recently. And then you're rebalanced into the crap, the stuff that's not moving. Because markets have been pretty much the same for the last 8 months. And before that, they were pretty much the same for the last 2 years. That's where you can get into a trap with some of these. Now, I still think that basic asset allocation 101, which is a good idea for certain portfolios, for long-term portfolios, that's what our global allocations are based on, but we have an override on there where we look at the fundamentals and look at what's happening in each of these areas. And still, though, look at it as a situation where we want to have full exposure to a lot of these areas that are doing well and maybe draw back a little bit on areas that aren't doing so well. Now, I'll tell you where this came into be a problem recently. So back in 2016, when markets were selling off and small caps and emerging markets in particular were having a hard time, they sold off pretty well. And what happened with a matter of days, they turned around. Now, we sold part of our position for a nice gain on the emerging markets in the beginning of 2016, didn't get hit with any of those losses. We still had a position there, didn't get hit with any of those losses. And at that point, it looked like things were very troubling for there. But then every market just came back very strong in the third or fourth month of that year. And it continued moving higher throughout the whole year of 2016. Now, there is something to be said about a rebalancing process in that circumstance. But again, how would you know when you wanted to invest in that or get out of that? It wasn't very apparent at that exact point. So all I'm saying is there's no magic bullet in looking at these kind of automated or automated cycle rebalancers versus looking, you know, versus looking at where, well, if something is up and down, you want to keep that allocation. It is nothing wrong with rebalancing. There's kind of a fine line, I guess, is my point. But, you know, I don't know how you can find the highs necessarily or find the lows as easily as there as this DIA. When you look it up on the web and define their particular dynamic asset allocation model, which is based on tactical allocation, how they really can do that on a long-term basis very successfully. But it is possible. That ends that segment of listener questions. If you want to ask me a question, of course, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and click on the Ask Andrew button. And that will give you access to ask a question. And hopefully we can get it on the show in an upcoming episode. And if it is a little bit more private and something that maybe is more direct, I'll try to answer it in an email as best as I can. Listen, our job with this show for the last 10 years has been about the same thing. It's been about helping, educating, and providing a good amount of knowledge on the in the areas of investing. So that's why we have guests on. That's why we bring on different opinions. That's why sometimes bring on people who have some crazy opinions and crazy ideas. We want to understand and learn from nothing. Nothing is out of reach. Now, before we went to the listener questions, I had mentioned something. I had mentioned that I want to talk about this whole best funds, best stock, 10 best for the next however long, top picks. I was reading Investor's Business Daily this weekend, which I very much enjoy. I don't read it every weekend, to be honest with you, but I read it regularly. And one of the articles, let me see if I can grab the paper here. Here. Let's see if I can find it. One of the articles was something like, the top 10 funds. Yeah, a lot of paper rustling. Oh, here it is. The 2007s, on page 810, 2007's best mutual funds. Now, I don't know, first of all, if this is sponsored or not. I don't know. It says on the top IBD special report. I don't think it's sponsored, but okay. So what they have is a list of various sectors from U.S. diversified equity and growth and blend and value all the way down to small cap and international stock, et cetera. And they have, let's see, one, two, three, about five different funds and compare that to its benchmark over a 1, 3, 5, and 10-year average, what the Morningstar category is, and you know, I didn't even notice this one part I'm going to mention in a second. And it's if it's closed to new investors. Okay? So the first part talks about, okay, the U.S. diversified funds. What's the best? So it's five of them. One of the things that I just noticed this actually was when you look at the Morningstar category, there's a large growth, a large blend, a mid-cap blend, a small growth, and a small blend. So they're comparing this to the S&P 500. And they're looking at small caps versus large caps in the same grouping. First of all, that's ridiculous. There is no reason to be doing that. The way that you look at funds is not simply to look at performance. Performance is important. There's no question about that. You know, listen, it's like the, what's the story? The guy in the elevator, he goes gambling. And he meets with his wife later in the elevator to go back to the room. He gets in the elevator. He says to his wife, well, how'd you do? And she says, oh, I lost $20. He starts screaming at her, what are you doing? You're losing money. I can't believe it. What's going on with you? You're an idiot. I told you not to do it. You were new at this. You're nuts. She said, how'd you do? He says, I lost $200. And she starts screaming all and said, what's the difference with it? He says, but I lost $200. But I know how to gamble. You know? So the point is that return is important and it's not just based on that. You don't want to look at all the other things that are, oh, it has a great Sharpe ratio. Oh my God, look at the beta. Oh, look at this, all the various statistics and the alpha and the Sharpe ratio and all this good stuff. And look at all these things that are going into it. And oh, the fund didn't do well, but it's got great statistics. That's a fund for me. That's stupid also. But why are we seeing all these headlines, the best stock picks for this year, or the top 10 mutual funds, or the best mutual funds for 2017? It's hogwash. It's headlines just to entice you. You have to look at the methodology that they're using. I don't see much methodology. Yeah, there's some paragraph at the top here of what they did here, but they're comparing small cap funds and mid cap funds and all that in the diversified domestic area. I just don't understand that. You know, yeah, you want to say this is the top from each area, fine. But then they have other areas that are just looking at historic returns. We don't know, for example, some of the things that are important. There's more to this than just looking at whether or not the fund is performed. Now, this could also be, by the way, in its kind of a crazy way, a little bit of an offensive move. Offense, not offensive. Offense move to hit against all of the discussion we're seeing lately about passive and ETFs. I was thinking that this could be that because mutual funds have been losing a lot of money recently, especially the active mutual funds, as the VIX has been down, as complacency is there, as markets continue to slowly but surely grind higher. What has happened is that we're seeing that there has been an exodus from actively managed mutual funds. That's stupid, by the way. I'm just going to tell you right now, there is no absolute way to invest. And anytime we see that there is these players out there, and I can name a few over the years that say this is the only way to invest, pick up your money and run. There are many different, that's why with all of our portfolios, generally, I think all of our portfolios I can speak of, we have multiple strategies that are in that are embraced inside of the process. Not one thing. I can remember back in 2000 and before 1999, when value was killing growth, everybody was invested in a variety of different value players, and then value turned and all of a sudden growth was playing, value was getting killed. They jumped ship as they were getting, you know, down 15, 20%. They jumped ship into growth. Growth was doing great for a year and then plummeted from 2000 to 2002. They were chasing returns, but thinking this was the only way. If only you had a balanced portfolio between value and growth back then, think about how great you would have done instead of trying to be just in this one place, just in technology, just in Asia, just in ETFs. Now, you may say, well, ETFs are different. They're just a low-cost way of investing. Yeah, I agree with that. But there's something to be said for certain areas in particular that a mutual fund and an active manager is a much better position to be in. But getting back to this for a second, what was so annoying to me about this? What bothered me so much about this whole idea of just giving you a headline and trying to persuade you that, oh, this is something you should even read, because they didn't do the things that I thought they should do. First of all, let me explain what that means. There's a variety of statistics that should be used, and this is just a partial list that I jotted down, of what you should look at when trying to discern whether or not the investment is appropriate. And in particular, I'm talking about mutual funds and active mutual funds. You can look at, of course, ETFs and passive mutual funds as well, but what are they doing? They're just trying to emulate the index. So that's not anything that, you know, when we're looking at that, if you want to invest in an index, then just buy an ETF. I have no problem with that. But when we're looking at other areas such as small cap international, Latin America, maybe Asia, emerging market bonds, there's a few others on this list. Probably it's better to be in a active mutual fund, a long short fund, alternative strategy fund, a floating rate fund. There's a variety of things that you should be. So here's some of the things you should be looking at. For example, up and down action, if you want to start scoring whether or not this mutual fund is a place that can meet the criteria of what you want to invest in. What are the fees, of course? That's something important. What's the management's tenure? How about the concentration of positions? I can't tell you how many times I've looked at funds and we see that, wow, this fund has done, wow, really well. Look at that. And then I start looking at, well, 60% of their funds are in the top 60% of their holdings are in the top 10% of the fund. That means that they did a great job at picking something, but you know, if any of these things cycle, they may be in bad shape. And the probability of having a diversified approach that is a winner is very low probability. They're not going to be able to pick the best of the best on a consistent basis moving forward. Just, I mean, yes, over a few cycles, they could probably do so. But I could show you so many examples of funds that have broken down because they had such a large concentration in a particular area. What about actual adherence to their stated style? In other words, we don't want to see what's called style drift, where it's a giving us great returns that are more like small caps, but it's in a large cap category or vice versa. As a matter of fact, we had a situation with this recently where we had a fund that was supposedly a small cap fund, and it really wasn't performing as well as a small cap fund should, considering the benchmark and its peers. So you want to look at also peer to peer, how is it doing against its peers? I started looking at this and saying, well, what's going on? And we dug into it, and we found that over the last quarter that the average size, the capitalization size of the stocks within the portfolio had jumped up because they kept the fund open, even though they really had a liquidity problem of buying some of the smaller caps out there because the fund had done very well. And what they did was that instead of closing down the fund, they actually went out and started buying larger cap stocks to meet the inflows that came in. And now what that turned into was more like a mid-cap stock fund versus a small-cap stock fund because of the average weighted capitalization of the securities within the fund. And that I said, wait a second, that is not what we want. We want for this section and the sixth sector of the portfolios that we manage, we want a small-cap fund. We want a small-cap growth fund, a small-cap value fund, or a small-cap blend fund. So what we did was we cut that fund. We said, you know what? Thank you very much. We made a lot of money with you. Very good. You're not changing your ways. We had some conversations with management and they're not going to close down. We said, well, we'll just take our money. That's it. You know, we're allowed to vote with our feet, as we say. So you have to put all these into play as well as performance to really get a decent level of comparison of what is a good fund. And every organization has their own scoring process. Morningstar use their stars, and there's a lot that goes behind that. You look at S&P, what they do with that. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to look at this, but please stay away from any of those articles and investing in those when they look at what the 10 top funds are, or the best stock, you know, stocks for the next decade are, or the best mutual funds for 2017. I think we're all drawn to it, but that's not something that I think we should really play with. All right, closing on that. I guess we have to get to this whole despicable and distasteful conversation about the narrative. The narrative. You've heard about it, right? Oh, the narrative now is that we're switching over to this and that, and it's going to be a bull market, blah, 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 blah. Or, well, the narrative has been that there's some concern about the geopolitics in Europe and the banking sector. And however, usually the narrative is a, what is it, by the way? You know, what is this whole narrative and narrative fitting, as I call it? This whole idea of that, well, let's find some information that we can use for either a bullish or a bearish or some other kind of methodology to find reasons why to do something. It's kind of a new phrase. I mean, generally in the markets, a new phrase that's being used as, I think, a psychological process to try to manipulate in the investment world. It's trying to take behavioral finance to a different level because, of course, we're all sheep, right? We just follow along whatever is said on various news and media, podcasts. Let me give an example of what the narrative is in this very recent time period, what just happened on Friday. So Friday's bill defeat would have been bad for stocks. That was the narrative. Whoa, this is going to be very bad. If we do this, it's going to be a terrible thing. It's been used by politicians to try to prop up the idea of voting for the bill, and it's been used by stock market, those negative on the stock market saying, well, this could happen. The narrative, you know, this is what we're going to do. It's also been used as from various prognosticators about what they believe. Well, you know, if this happens, then that happens. That's kind of how a narrative forms. It's a It's a cause and effect. It's a relationship of if this goes on, then that has to happen. It's also used as an explanation. Well, stocks didn't move higher because of this, or stocks went down because of that, or stocks moved up because of the Fed. If the Fed, for example, let's get back to Friday. So we have the narrative. The narrative is, if the bill is defeated, it would be bad for stocks. Why? Because the narrative said it's going to be a loss of political credibility. The narrative said that it's going to be much more difficult to pass any tax reform. The narrative said that if that's the case, that, well, many of the skills that Trump had promised to bring forth as a negotiator, that would be a problem. This is the narrative. This is what we're hearing. And there's a change to that narrative. Wait a minute. The healthcare bill was pulled. Now the narrative that you hear is, well, this is good for stocks. Now we're going to be able to get on to tax reform much easier. So now all of a sudden this is being pumped into the world of investing, and the narrative is changed. It's fitted to what they want it to be. Remember when the narrative was, well, the Fed increasing rates will drive up the dollar. And up until the Fed hiked rates last week, the dollar had been moving higher, right in form. So now what you have is, oh, it was said that this was going to happen. It is happening. I believe it's going to happen. Well, that must be true. Then there's a change to that narrative. The Fed hikes the rate, but the dollar, if you remember this, the dollar went down. So now all of a sudden we have to refit the narrative. We refit it into, well, the Fed hiked the rates, but they were a little bit more dovish. Therefore, they're going to be less likely, it seems, from what they've talked about raising rates in a real strong pace over time. The dollar actually should go down now. So the new narrative is that the dollar is going to go down because we have the Fed slowing down on their rate hike promise. Also, the fact that there's some political losses with regard to the healthcare. And so now the new narrative is, well, the dollar is going to move lower. And therefore, you should have X, Y, and Z. So this has been, it seems to me that lately, the whole idea of trying to shift the conscious efforts of investors based on constant talk and, as the Fed would call it, a communication strategy, okay, of, you don't want to use the word manipulate, but of helping to push the idea of one thing or the other is what's going on. And then we have the narrative fitting. Again, we say, well, it was supposed to do this, but it didn't do this because of that. So it's, the narrative was wrong, but let's just adjust it and fit it to where we want to be. So why do we have this? There's basically two reasons as I see it. Well, as human beings, we seem to need reasons and rationale for everything. We like the story. We like to understand why something happened. Something can't just happen because of no reason. It has to have a reason. You know, there's got to be something that we can explain why the market moved. Why else do you think that you'd have media, which is the second part of this, having labels? Well, markets moved down because profit taking on the oil patch. Markets moved up because of excitement over new drug rules. We need to have explanations, reasons, rationale, or else we just seemingly can't function. Right? I mean, we can't make it through a day without knowing why something happened. I'm guilty of this. I want to know what happened. Why did it happen? And then you got those out there saying, well, that's not the case. Stocks move up regardless or down, regardless of what's happening in the news cycle and what's going on in politics and all that. I don't buy that either. I think there's somewhere in between. But also the media needs labels. And they need a quick headline grab. They need to explain it. They need to understand and have us understand what's happening. But more importantly, I think right now everybody knows that investors are easily swayed by two things. What are the two things that drive investors? You know this. The two greatest components of investor behavior has to be linked to greed and fear. So the greed comes in different, and the fear comes into different categories, but greed of what? Wow, I need to make that money. I want to make that money. I'm going to put my money in there. I know I'm going to make that money. I'm going to be rich. I'm going to be a billionaire. I'm going to invest in this, whatever it is, and I'm going to make a lot of money. So you have greed factors that are very present. Fear, depending on the investor, could be a lot more powerful. The fear of losing money, also the fear of missing out. Now, we've seen that work, that second part work in times. The fear of missing out happens often when markets are at their final stage. If you ever looked at the various stages of market cycles, once you get into that final stage of when a market is peaking out or on its way to peaking out, on its way to going, you know, higher and higher in the last gasp, last move, that could last a while, by the way, you have a lot of people that are in fear of losing out. They finally say, oh my God, forget it. They capitulated. I want to make the money on this. I don't want to lose out anymore. I'm so sick of not being involved. And what happens is they have that fear of losing out. So you have greed and fear. And we have put such a premium on material items over the last number of years. And that has been, have you read Bloomberg recently? All they talk about is the, you know, the greatest vacation. Here's a watch you want. It's like, you know, $98,000 for the watch. Here's the top sports cars. They start at $375. You know, here's the places that you want a vacation. It's like, you know, $18,000 a week. I mean, we put such a premium on material items. And most success in modern times is measured by wealth and possessions. I don't think it was always like this. To a degree it was, but we had a different, it was a different level of how we measured our success. My grandfather measured success in his knowledge. Now, that turned out he did okay for himself, but you know, these days, everything seems to be measured by what I have, my junk, my stuff, my bank account. And as such, greed and fear are a great motivating factor, and the narrative can be used to manipulate that and to create an environment that basically herds the cattle, herds the sheep. And guess who that cattle is? You and me. So you got to keep that narrative moving. You got to keep it changing. You got to keep it adjusting over time. And don't forget that you'll buy into that narrative. Yeah, that makes sense. You know, there's, stock markets moved higher because the Fed signaled that they were more dovish than this. Yeah, but okay, that's great. But don't forget, we also have algos that are pushing this also. And whether or not there is a good news or bad news day by the Fed, many of them have been more dovish than expected. But still, have you noticed that on any Fed day, given for the most part in recent history, markets just move higher? I think like probably 85% of the time, at least, if not more. That's all algo driven. Not the investor saying, oh, yeah. And everybody's saying this at the same time. It's narratives that are being created and fed to the news media to go along with the directionality of what the desired outcome is. And everybody's happy. Watch the narrative. Watch narrative fitting. Do yourself a favor. Stay away from it. Something we've talked about in different degrees before, but I've been hearing this whole the narrative in both markets and politics and in all sorts of areas that I just think it's something that we have to be aware of and be cautious of, not to buy in too heavily into what they're trying to tell us. No, it's not a giant conspiracy, so just please don't take it that way either. But there's something to be said about this. Use your own level of understanding, logic, research, and hard work to get to the answers that you need rather than just relying on the narrative. Put a sticky note on your computer. Kill the narrative. Kill the narrative. We're going to end it there before my blood pressure goes up any higher. Don't forget to join us next week when we have Tim Sykes on. And of course, I mentioned the beta testing of Investology with an E. Investology, advisor crafted, technology enhanced portfolios, a little thing we put together in terms of a great platform, and some of it at your request, by the way. It's taken us about a year and a half to build this, so we're at the point of real money beta testing. And you can have, you know, it's going to be just like you're opening an account. It's nothing different than that, but I'm asking for feedback and, you know, to a point that we could do a final launch. Other than that, you can ask me any questions you want. Find out more about us on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Of course, check out Trigger Charts as well and DH Unplugged each and every week on Tuesday nights, where we come streaming to you live, myself and John C. Dvorak. Other than that, I wish you a great week and I'll see you next week. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.